Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Bill McKibben. He's an environmentalist, author, and activist. His new book is called Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. And he will be in Santa Fe on Wednesday, the 9th of November at 7 in the evening at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center in a benefit for the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, what a pleasure to be with you.
Now, let's talk about your latest book. It's called Earth, or Earth. I'm not sure how you say it. It's spelled with two A's.
There's an extra A in
there. Yeah, and the idea is that this Earth that we're standing on is not the same one we were born onto, and let's not call it by the same name. How drastic are the current changes caused by global warming as opposed to the threat of global warming?
I mean, look, the planet remains in certain ways the same correct number of continents, you know. Gravity still applies, but in fundamental ways, it really is shifting and even faster than we would have thought. I mean, I wrote the first book about climate change for a general audience 22 years ago, and even then we didn't think it was going to come this fast. If you look at the oceans, as they absorb more carbon from the atmosphere, they're about 30% more acid than they were 40 years ago. If you look at the satellite view of Earth, and think back to those first pictures that came back from Apollo 8 in my boyhood in the late 1960s, the Earth has about 40% less ice than it did in those days, summer sea ice in the Arctic. Pretty much name a phenomenon, and it's shifting. I mean, look, just think about the 18 months or so since that book originally came out. 2010 was the warmest year for which we have records. 19 nations set new all-time temperature records last year, some of them amazing. We were on the phone with our organizing crew, our 350.org team in Pakistan in July of last year, and one of them said, "It's hot here today." And I was surprised to hear him say it because it's always hot in Pakistan in the summer. And he said, "No, it's really hot. We just set the new all-time Asia temperature record. It was 129 degrees here today."
Oh, my God.
Which even for New Mexico would be hot in the middle of summer. One of the things that we're seeing, maybe in the last couple of years, the most dramatic manifestation of this changing planet is the effect on hydrology, on the way that water moves around the Earth. And if you want one fact to kind of help you understand this century, it would be that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. Simple physics. The atmosphere is about 4% wetter than it was 40 years ago, which is a very large change in what had been a very stable parameter of the planet. And what it means is we load the dice for both drought and for flood. In arid areas, we're getting higher temperatures, more evaporation, and some more drought. Poster child at the moment, depending on your hemisphere, is the Horn of Africa or Texas. Texas, Oklahoma are in a deeper drought than the Dust Bowl. When they had a big fires outside Austin a few weeks ago, the head of the Texas Forest Fire Fighting Service said no human being has ever fought fire in conditions like this. And he was, I think, essentially correct. The humidity had dropped to zero. The temperature was through the roof. Meanwhile, once that water's up in the air, it's coming down, and now it comes down often in very, very, very large volumes. So last year, it was Pakistan, greatest floods in its history, a quarter of the country underwater, 20 million people out of their homes. This year, much of the action shifted to North America. You remember the flooding along the Missouri and the Mississippi at the beginning of the year? It's my part of the world up here in Vermont that took it in the chin this fall. We had absolutely record rainstorms, never had days of rain as intense as these because we were watching 200-year-old covered bridges floating away down rivers. The whole state is in this, you know, rack and ruin. And, of course, we're not alone. I mean, this week alone, we've seen record flooding that's killed 150 people across El Salvador and Nicaragua. Bangkok is essentially underwater today with the greatest flooding in its history. Manila in the Philippines the last week. Pakistan again with thousands of people dead and millions more out of their homes with record monsoon flooding. It goes on and on and on and on.
You write about a very important fact about oil, and a fascinating fact, which is that a barrel of oil contains as much energy as 25,000 hours of human labor, and the implications of that are essentially the essence of our civilization. So the amount of, as you write, the amount of oil that an American uses in a year amounts to 300 years of basically human sweat and toil. The trade-off for that is that we're destroying the very civilization that we created by warming it into oblivion. So the question is this. In your view, is it possible to replace this energy that is warming us too terribly much with clean forms of energy and continue with the kind of civilization that we've come to enjoy and, in fact, spread this civilization to other parts of the world?
It's not possible to do exactly the things that we've been doing, I don't think. The amount of energy that we waste in this country is enormous. And by waste, sometimes I mean just, you know, we don't turn things off, but also I mean we do things that just are crazy. I mean, we've spent most of our money since the end of World War II on the project of building bigger houses farther apart from each other. I don't think there's enough solar power and enough wind power around the world to allow everyone to build their own, you know, starter castle for entry-level monarchs, you know. But I think that's okay, because I don't think it's actually made us very happy. I think that there is plenty of energy if we use renewable sources wisely to allow us to build strong, sufficient, and beautiful communities. I think we'll need to replace some of our consumption with connection. And I think that if we do, that trade-off will be well worth making.
One thing that your book makes abundantly clear is that despite all the claims to the contrary, like if we have to use solar power and wind power and switch over, that will cost jobs, that the reality of not dealing with climate change will be, and in fact already is, unbelievably expensive. You've already mentioned a few examples of that, like bridges being washed away, infrastructure, and so on. Give us some more examples. What does that look like? What does the expense of not dealing with global warming look like?
Well, I think there's not enough money on the face of the earth to even begin to deal with it if we let it get out of hand. The last big sort of estimate came from a British economist. The government hired one of its most eminent economists to try and figure out, a guy named Nicholas Stern, what the bill would be, and he said it would be bigger than both World Wars and the Great Depression combined in real terms. The insurance industry are the people that we ask to analyze risk for us, and they're flashing every red light they've got. There was a study conducted by Munich Re, the biggest insurance company on earth, and the Harvard School of Public Health not long ago, that said if we continue getting bigger and more powerful storms, that it will reduce parts of even the U.S. economy, say along the Gulf Coast, to what they described as developing world conditions. This is serious stuff.
During the 1970s, there was a profound change in thinking, and books came out like Small is Beautiful, and there was this Club of Rome report on the limits of growth. And as you write, these books and these thinkers turned out not only to be correct, but, I mean, amazingly prescient. But what was really surprising to me was, I mean, I'm reading your chapter, and there's something I didn't know. During the Carter administration, only a third of Americans believed that economic growth was a good thing. The others either didn't believe that or were ambivalent. What was that period like and what happened?
Well, it was right after the first Earth Day and the first oil shocks, and we were open to the idea that maybe something was going wrong, you know. And we were also open to the idea that human beings had other possibilities, that there were different, more interesting ways to organize our societies and things. And so there was plenty of willingness to entertain the idea that maybe growth should come to an end and we should start growing not physically but in other ways. In some ways, the epic battle was fought in the presidential election of 1980, when Jimmy Carter kind of represented that worldview. Remember him sitting in his sweater in the slightly chilly White House.
Right.
Took on Ronald Reagan, who proclaimed that it was all nonsense and said it's morning in America again. And his vision won, and shortly after he won, he ripped the solar panels off the White House roof that Jimmy Carter had put there, and now we are where we are. You know? So a moment lost, I'm afraid.
I always think of growth of economies in like ecosystem metaphors. So if you have a growth industry, it's sort of like a little tree that grows into a big tree, or a bunch of little trees that grow into a bunch of big trees. But eventually they reach their correct size. They reach their natural size, and then they bear fruit for many, many years. They go through a life cycle and they die. But the requirements of the economy that we live in, which is based on investors who want growth stocks that are traded publicly, and they always want everything to grow, is that you're basically, it'd be like having a forest and pumping hormones into it or something like that until it grew through the stratosphere into the, you know, up to the moon.
Yeah. The only things that believe in perpetual growth are governments and cancer cells, you know. And our government's just taken it as its role to foster this endless growth to the end of time. There's two problems with that. One is the clear environmental one, that eventually you run out of stuff. And, you know, if we're the thing that's growing on the little plate of jelly there in the lab, the jelly runs out, you know. The other problem is that growth at a certain point isn't making us any happier, if anything, the opposite. When they do polling about how happy Americans are with their lives, the percentage who say they're very happy peaks in 1956, even though we've trebled our average standard of living since then. So in those terms, all our endless consumption has been largely for naught. In fact, maybe the reverse. We've gotten somewhat less happy, and the reason's pretty clear. As we've devoted that growth basically to sprawling out across suburbia, we've started to lose track of each other. We run into each other literally less often. The average American has half as many close friends as the average American of 50 years ago. And there's not enough stuff to compensate for that. So on all accounts, growth is no longer the order of the day, at least in the developed world, I think.
We're talking to environmentalist and author Bill McKibben. You describe the history of this country in your new book as a series of national projects that started with the settling of the continent, good or bad as that may be in the view of the people whose lives were destroyed by that settling of the continent, but nevertheless, and ended up in the 20th century with things like putting people on the moon. Where are we now? Are we out of national projects?
I think that the sort of big things that we should be doing are not as obvious anymore. The one big national project we probably have left is converting to green energy, but even that's really better done at a local and a local level, because the logic of the sun and the wind is that they're inherently local. And I think it's probably beginning to make less sense to have a huge federal apparatus for as big a country as we are. I got to say, I feel far like I understand far better and am in more touch with what's going on in Vermont than what's going on in Washington, where things seem out of control. I've thought that a lot this year, because we're fighting this huge battle over this pipeline, and our battle has to be in Washington. But boy, what a snake bit, what a difficult place to work that is.
Could you talk about that pipeline and the battle you're fighting?
Sure. This is a pipeline that would run from the tar sands of northern Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico. It's 1,700 miles long, and so one danger, not even really a danger, a certainty, is that it will leak along the way. The precursor pipeline leaked 12 times in the last year. Another problem is that these tar sands are disgusting, where they're mining them. They've destroyed endless amounts of native land. They've only gotten at 3% of the oil so far, but they've already moved more earth than they did for the Great Wall of China and the Great Pyramid and the Suez Canal and the 10 largest dams on earth. But the biggest problem is that this pool of oil up in Canada is the second largest pool of carbon on earth after the Saudi oil fields. Of course, it was burning the Saudi oil fields that first got us in the trouble that we're in with climate change. More than anything else, that's what's raised the temperature of the earth a degree. And, you know, when we did that the first time, we didn't know anything about global warming. So there was, I guess, no reason not to. But now we do know. And if we just repeat the same exercise with the next Saudi Arabia, then we're very, very silly people indeed. That's why we've been trying to stop this huge pipeline that's one of the linchpins for further investment. Our foremost climatologist, Jim Hansen, has told us, the NASA scientist has told us all, that if we tap heavily into those tar sands, then, as he put it, it's essentially game over for the climate. So beginning in August, we had the biggest civil disobedience action in a generation in this country in Washington. Over 2 weeks, there were about 1,250 of us who were arrested and taken to jail. And we've continued this campaign to try and get the president, who will make this decision himself without Congress in the way, to block the permit for this Keystone Pipeline. We'll be reassembling in Washington, this time not to get arrested, but on November 6th, exactly 1 year before the election. We're going to circle the White House with people, and all those people will be carrying placards from with quotes from the president's 2008 campaign, something like, "It's time to end the tyranny of oil," or, "In my administration, the rise of the oceans will begin to slow," and things like that. We need them very much to take that take that cue from their own campaign instead of bowing, as I'm afraid they've bowed a few too many times, to the power of big oil and big money.
We talked recently to Juan Gonzalez, who writes eloquently in his new book, it's called News for All the People, about the crucial importance of media decentralization. And it turns out that decentralization, as you're talking about, is really advantageous in many ways. What are you seeing, particularly in terms of food production?
Yes, as we're looking at local food production, one of the things that people sometimes say is, the only way we could possibly feed the world is if we have this big high-tech agricultural system. As it turns out, you get more bang for the buck in terms of calories per acre with smaller farms. The smaller the farm, the more calories you can produce, which, if you think about it, makes sense. That's because place after place, the farmer can pay more attention to his fields than he would otherwise. That's good news, and it helps us understand why there's been this kind of steady increase now in small local farming around the country. For 10 years, the fastest growing part of our agricultural sector has been local agriculture, and that's very good news. The USDA reported last year that the number of farms in America had increased instead of decreased for the first time in 150 years. That's the most cheerful statistic I know.
It's still, though, a pretty small percentage of the food we eat, isn't it?
I don't know what the actual percentage is, but the trajectory is pretty cool. The number of farmers' markets has doubled and doubled and doubled again. It's by far the fastest growing part of our food economy. And, of course, it would go much faster if we did the single obvious thing of requiring fossil fuel to pay for the damage that carbon does in the atmosphere.
Namely, taxing carbon.
Yeah, by allowing ExxonMobil, in essence, to use the atmosphere as an open sewer into which to dump its waste for free, we give a big subsidy to heavy users of fossil energy, of which agribusiness is one of the biggest.
There's so many great examples in the book about food. And, for example, this is the way the media distorts things. There's an example in the book about how there was a report about how Mayan corn farmers were really unproductive because they only produced a certain amount of corn per acre, which was way less than what large-scale industrial agriculture produced in terms of the amount of corn per acre. But it turned out there was 10 times as much food per acre produced by these Mexican farmers because they interplanted things. Talk about that. I mean, the
first time I saw this, I was in China. And I, you know, got out of the car and went over to look at this cornfield by the side of the road and was amazed to find that between the corn plants, there were growing bean plants, lots. And, of course, you can't do this if you have a huge agribusiness operation because you got to drive the tractor up and down the rows and it would squash all the bean plants, so to speak. But you can if you've got smaller plots of land and more people working on them. And that kind of intercropping, as it's called, is one of the secrets of peasant agriculture around the world and one of the reasons it can be so productive.
There are also incredibly interesting and innovative things that people are doing, which combine, and this is, I think, a very important thing, that combine the old ways and scientific ways to do small-scale farming that, for example, doesn't use pesticides, but is very successful in controlling pests, and in fact, even more than pesticides in the long run, because resistant strains don't grow up. Give us some examples of that.
Yes, they're starting to do, people are starting to combine sort of very new techniques and understandings, about pheromones and things that can attract and repel pests with very old peasant knowledge of what plants help protect things and whatever. And so you're seeing very large experiments, or not experiments, very large parts of Africa and Indonesia and things where people are figuring out how to abandon pesticides. Now, the reason that they do this is less because they want what we call organic food and more because, A, they're very sick, the farmers, of having to deal with the effects of pesticides, which are nasty when you're applying them. You really don't want to wander around in a rice paddy all the time that's just filled with this kind of stuff. And they're expensive. The Green Revolution, as it is, this high-input kind of farming, has had its chief victim, the small farmers who just aren't able to afford the kind of stuff that people are putting out.
There's also this very interesting and very important contrast between, for example, large-scale hog farms that produce just huge amounts, urban metropolis amounts of sewage, which is just toxic. But then when you have a small-scale hog farm, which is on a farm with other kinds of things, that very same waste actually becomes productive.
That's right. I mean, there's theoretically there's a hog farm in Utah that's supposed to produce as much waste in a day as the city of Los Angeles, which is, if you think about it, fairly mind-blowing. And at that volume, obviously, sewage is an enormous problem. But, of course, for all of agriculture through all of time until fairly recently, manure has been not a problem but a blessing. You know, as long as you have a usable amount of it, you return fertility to the soil. And so it's, trying to figure out how to allow that to happen that's the challenge, and it's one of the reasons that small farms are finding good competitive niches in which to work.
And certainly farmers in so-called developing countries are very happy about finding non-pesticide organic ways to do things because they're more healthy and they basically use more labor but spend way less money on this stuff.
Exactly right. And that's why our systems that are so geared for using a lot of energy and hence very little labor are going to have to change a good deal, and it's going to be difficult.
How do you envision that change? Does the whole system have to fall apart? I mean, we've been witnessing since, I mean, your book makes it really clear that the beginning of the Reagan administration was a turning point. The country made a choice at that point to go backwards, to not heed the warnings that were in plain sight. And the money machines, the PR machines, the vote manipulating apparatus, and so on, seems just so incredibly powerful. I mean, does that have to just run its course? Can it be defeated, do you think?
Well, it's very hard. That's what we're sort of seeing in this pipeline fight, you know? Even when you have people like Barack Obama in power who are theoretically committed to different kinds of government, it's very, very hard. They named a new senior campaign advisor who'd been a big deal lobbyist for this pipeline. So, you know, that's why we've got things like Occupy Wall Street. People are beginning to wake up to the level of corporate dominance and things, and we'll see where it all comes out. It's hard. They've got all the money.
In a lot of ways, we are back to where we were 40 years ago, and in terms of looking at the economy and really looking again. I mean, certainly not everybody's doing it, but you're doing it, and I think a lot of forward-looking people are doing this, namely thinking about the kind of economy that would help us to survive and maybe to mitigate the worst effects of climate change and adapt to it. And as you write, we need not only a new system, but new metaphors to describe this system, to describe where we're going. What's your thinking about how to think about our future?
So we've been obsessed with growth for a long time. And I think one of the reasons we're obsessed with growth is that it has a kind of analog in our own lives. We all had periods of time when we grew, you know, got larger, and we kind of liked it, you know. And then there came that bittersweet moment when we weren't going to grow any larger ourselves, but when we were going to have to figure out other ways in which to grow and develop and things. And that would mean making choices and closing some of them off. So the metaphor that we need as a society, I think, and a civilization, has something to do with maturation, with maturity. I think that instead of growth, we're going to worry more in the decades ahead about stability, about resilience, about durability, especially as that which we can't prevent, the climate change that we've already committed ourselves to, makes life more difficult. I can tell you in Vermont right now, we're spending a lot of time and money trying to figure out how to protect what we have, how to keep our roads from washing away in the future, and so on and so forth. And that's money that won't be devoted to growing things. It'll be devoted to defending things, as it were.
We're talking to environmentalist and activist Bill McKibben. I really resonated to that section of your book where you're talking about the perpetual adolescence that we're in. I was recently trying to figure out what movie to go to, and I was looking at all the listings in town at the multiplexes, and they basically all boiled down to either weddings and dating movies or fighting and warrior movies. And I thought, that's it. Weddings and warriors. That's sort of who we are as a nation. That's how we represent ourselves. And, you know, getting married and fighting are things that you do when you're young, and there was no sense of maturity in it.
Yeah, there's some deep truth to that, and it's time to come out of our adolescence, you know? I mean, there's been something exciting about this 200-year period of growth, and you can feel that excitement when you go to some place like China right now. You know, it is kind of exciting to see. But the people that we prize most in our lives, the people we respect the most, are generally the ones who've matured best. And maturation at some level means figuring out you're not the absolute center of the world. You know, something that pretty much all our religious traditions, at least as far back as the Buddha, have tried to remind us, I think.
And that's really what nature reminds us of, too.
Absolutely. You get out in the big world, and it's hard to convince yourself that you're really the center of everything. And it's one of the reasons I think that we really like getting out into the wild. And also one of the reasons why it's sort of worrisome and scary for people who aren't used to it or haven't done it much before.
When you talk about the way of life that we might have in the future, it's not like a, as you say, it's not like a story of a beautiful, exciting new world. It's basically a world of survival in which we try to avoid the worst, and we are certainly setting ourselves up for the worst. In a way, that's, I mean, it sounds like marketing to say this, but in a way, it's a hard sell.
Well,
I mean,
it's only that way if we really make a whole series of mistakes. If we do it right, then I think we have very promising possibilities. I think that we can have much more localized economies and daily lives, which will be nice. They'll bring us in contact with lots of other people. I mean, people like the farmer's market more than the supermarket, and one reason is that when you go there, you have on average 10 times more conversations. So that's all good. And we live at this odd moment in history when we have the one really interesting new technology of my lifetime, the Internet, that allows us, even as we become more local and stay in our place more, to be in constant, ever-expanding contact with the world around us. So that's good, too.
The food system, in a lot of ways, is the center of a lot of these questions, because if you don't have food, you don't have anything. You've got nothing else going on. You have to feed people in this country. You have to feed people on a growing planet. And then, okay, you think about a more like staying in place, static, localized food system. Would that require basically mass migrations from, say, Dallas to Iowa?
No, I don't think so. Cities are very able to, in certain ways, they're the easiest place to imagine this really happening. The place that's hard, I mean, because cities by their nature are fairly efficient, you know. Probably New York City is the greenest place in the world, but the places that are harder are suburbs, you know, because they're so spread out and car dependent and the housing is badly built for energy use and that kind of thing. However, their one saving grace may be that an awful lot of Americans have half an acre of land, you know, and at the moment we use it for growing grass. I imagine we'll use it for growing other more useful things in the years ahead.
There is certainly a movement toward planting food in your yard, and there was kind of a, did you see this? There was an article in the paper about how somebody in Michigan planted raised beds with vegetables in their yard, and they were taken to task by the city for not having the right things in their yard. They were only supposed to plant flowers.
Yeah, this kind of stuff drives me out of my mind. You know, something like a third of Americans live in communities where they're not allowed to put up a clothesline because it somehow would offend people to look at people's underwear flapping in the breeze or something. This kind of stuff is just silliness. I hope we get over it sooner rather than later, because there's really no excuse for it at this point.
When we look at energy production and look at the possibilities for truly clean, green energy production in the future, people talk about clean coal. That seems like an oxymoron to me. And then people talk about nuclear, which also has a lot of problems. How do you envision nuclear energy as part of America, or not as part of America's future?
I don't think it's going to be a huge part. Look, you know, in carbon terms, it's relatively clean. But post-Fukushima, it's hard for me to imagine it really getting a big swell behind it. I mean, they had to evacuate a large swath of land. It seems to me the people that live in those rings around proposed nuclear power plants are going to want to think two and three times. More to the point, I don't think that it's going to be a big part of the solution because it's incredibly expensive. Only governments build nuclear power plants, in essence, and if you're going to spend that kind of subsidy, the economic modeling shows you get more bang for the buck doing conservation and doing wind and solar and things like that. So my guess is that we're not going to see a huge renaissance of nuclear power plants in this country.
If we were to put the research and development dollars into making highly efficient solar panels out of materials that were readily available and generate our electricity that way, maybe do it in a way that was more localized. And we could generate the amount of electricity to maintain, okay, maybe some conservation, but basically to maintain the lifestyles that we have now. Would that be a good and desirable thing?
I don't think we're going to be able to generate quite that quantity of electricity. And I think that really what we're starting to figure out is that we want to live in slightly different ways anyway. Ones that will be that'll place more stress on community and less on consumption. And so I think we'd be wise to build our energy system along that model, to think in terms of what the engineers are calling distributed generation. And certainly in New Mexico, you can imagine every house with a set of solar panels and all tied into a grid and the sunlight falling on your shingles, making you a little utility, firing electrons off to your neighbor, a farmer's market and electrons.
There was an example in your book of some people who kind of did an experiment, and they pretended they were going to the frontier in Montana in the mid-19th century just to live that lifestyle and do chores and tend animals and so on. Describe that to us. It was amazing.
It was like a PBS show or something. You know, the PBS's idea of a reality show. Instead of, you know, Fat Farm or something, it was Frontier Town. And they expected everyone to be, oh, this is terrible. You know, I can't watch TV. Turns out that most of the people involved, and especially the kids, completely kind of got into the whole thing. And that afterwards, a couple of the participants, you know, sold their homes and moved back out to the edge of nowhere and built themselves shanties and kind of went on with life the way they'd been living it in the 19th/21st century. So just a kind of reminder that our notion that more is always better isn't always true, and that the desire for actual contact, for some more content in our lives, is powerful, and maybe especially true for young people. One of the things they liked about this experiment was that they got to spend a lot of time with their parents, who were there at home doing the work of the home instead of being out all the time.
Imagine that, wanting to spend time with your parents.
A concept foreign to us, but one that has marked every other culture that we've ever heard of and studied.
And maybe really not that foreign to us. I mean, I'm somebody who lives next door to her mother and am so very grateful for that. And I think if you really look at it, besides for some people, not all people, a little moment during adolescence, unless there's abuse or neglect or just major problems, people tend to like their parents.
Absolutely. There's probably even some evolutionary advantage to it, you would think. And, look, think about evolution. We're not that far descended from, you know, the moment when we all sat around on the floor of the savanna picking lice out of each other's fur. You know, that's sort of where we came from. We're socially minded animals. And it's no wonder that the kind of disconnected world we've built doesn't make us as happy as we imagine it should.
When I read your book, and again, we're talking about the book Earth, spelled E-A-A-R-T-H, by Bill McKibben. In the first chapter or chapters of the book, one feels not quite, but almost a despair about really making this world better, not to mention trying to restore the world that we grew up in and that we love. And then in the next parts of the book, where you describe all the amazing things that are going on in agriculture and other parts of the world, where you describe the possibility of community in all these places, including the example you just gave, and the way you describe Vermont and the things that people are doing to cultivate community and farmers markets and solar energy and things like that there, you feel hopeful. And then you go back to your own life. So I'm here in New Mexico, and yeah, there's some incentives for solar power and so on, but one feels an incredible need for, first of all, the ability to participate in a meaningful way. Sure, you can write letters and so on, but the Obama administration so far is showing such an utter lack of leadership and abandonment of the campaign promises that you mentioned and the will of the people. And so you wonder, what is the best course of action that we can take that's meaningful?
Yeah, this is just the question that I've been struggling with for a long time. And, you know, my best answer is we got to do things in our communities, and that's really important, and it's also really not enough. We also have got to build movements. Writing a letter to your congressman is a good idea, but it's much more powerful if there are thousands of people uniting. And that's, you know, one of the things, I mean, when I'm in Santa Fe, one of the things that I'll be remembering is this great day of art action that we had all over the world, and one of the 20 sites for it was Santa Fe, with people creating this beautiful flash flood in a dry riverbed last year, and the ways we were able to show that around the world and get people excited and involved. And that's one of the reasons that there were, you know, 1,250 people willing and ready to go to jail in the U.S., you know, a few weeks ago. That's the kind of movements that we have to build.
What do you think about Occupy Wall Street as part of that movement?
I think it's great. I think that they've understood. My first response when I saw it was to say, you know what, it's about time. Wall Street's been occupying the atmosphere for the last quarter century. The reason we can never get any action on climate change is because of corporate dominance of our politics. So this is a pretty good thing to be occupying them back a little bit and helping raise some consciousness, as we used to say, about this sort of thing.
Tell us about your organization, 350.org.
350 takes its name from what the scientists tell us is the most carbon we can safely have in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million, a number we're already well past, unfortunately. But because Arabic numerals cross linguistic boundaries, we took that scientific data point as our rallying cry, and we've managed to build the first big global grassroots climate movement. We've had about 15,000 rallies and demonstrations in every country on Earth except North Korea, and that's really exciting. And as I say, now we're kind of sharpening the focus, bringing it to bear with things like these actions in Washington.
The website for 350 is 350.org. Bill McKibben is the author of many books, the latest one of which is called Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. And Bill McKibben will be here in Santa Fe on Wednesday, the 9th of November at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. It's a benefit for the Santa Fe Art Institute, and they're on the web at sfai.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it immensely.
And I'd like now to welcome Diane Karp and Michelle Laflamme-Childs from the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is hosting this event with Bill McKibben. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Mary Charlotte. A pleasure to be here with you.
So tell us what else is going on besides the event at the Lenzic on Wednesday.
Well, actually, this is a sort of prelude to another large community art action that we're hoping to bring forth in the late spring, early summer. And it begins with this marvelous talk that Bill McKibben is going to present to the community on November 9th at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic. But it's not just his talk. Obviously, part of what's going on is the kind of thing that always goes on at the Art Institute. It's a community collaboration. And so we're going to be bringing performers from all kinds of organizations here in Santa Fe that have to do with art and environment and environmental art. And we're also hoping that all of the people who come will participate in an audience art action that we're going to record by video.
At the Lenzic?
At the Lenzic, sitting in their seats. And we're going to record it by video and photography, and we're going to post it up on our website, and it's also obviously going to go up on the 350.org website.
Can you give us a hint of what?
It will have something to do with the idea of moving from
coal to sun.
Uh-huh.
And the idea...
There's kind of darkness and light metaphors in there.
Mm, yes, yes. You're very perceptive there, Charlotte.
Well suited to an art action.
Yes, and so it will be something we're going to have spoken word poetry, and we're going to have performance pieces, and we're going to introduce a very important large-scale work that's coming out of Little Globe, which is the community arts program. And Little Globe has been working on a major opera called Piece of Coal. And it really centers on the fact that here in Santa Fe, where we take for granted the fact that we've got the cleanest air and the most beautiful, clearest sky, we're not all that far from the Four Corners region. And the San Juan coal plant that's up there is one of the nastiest, most polluting coal plants in the United States. And it produces a hefty part of our electric every day.
Right.
And so the idea is to focus a little bit on the fact that, yeah, we don't live in Farmington, and we don't have to put up with all that pollution in the air and all of the asthma and all of the byproducts of that pollution.
But some of it travels.
So, some of it travels, but I think it's deeper, and that's that we're still responsible. We turn on our electric, you know, appliances,
right.
And we have electricity in our houses, and we really don't stop and think about where it comes from. And New Mexico, that has such a potential to be an alternative energy source here in New Mexico and a model for the world, we're not really focusing on that. So it's a kind of desire to bring awareness to the other possibilities for energy production in our wonderful state.
There have been movements and EPA regulators and so on who have tried to regulate that coal plant and bring the carbon emissions way, way, way down, and the PNM basically has been fighting it tooth and nail.
Well, of course they are, because what they're saying is it will be so costly, but had PNM been more responsible over all these last 20 years, it would have been an incremental expenditure that they were putting in.
And as Bill McKibben just told us, as you just heard, the cost of not doing anything is so much higher.
I also wanted to mention that in conjunction with the Bill McKibben talk, the Art Institute is having an open call exhibition that will open that evening, the evening of the event, for those folks that buy the benefit tickets, and will open the next day on November 10th. All work of all medium is accepted. It just has to be delivered to the Art Institute, gallery ready by November 4th.
And it has to be work that deals with environmental issues in whatever form, whatever artist would like to submit. And as is always the case with our community open call, the idea is not to jury, but to let people bring the art that they care about and share it.
Diane Karp and Michelle LaFlamme-Childs are with the Santa Fe Art Institute, sfai.org. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.